We'll hear arguments first this morning in Griffin against Oceanic Contractors. Mr. Chafin, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. This is a case involving the interpretation of a very old seaman's wage statute, a statute that had its origin first in 1790 and later came to be known as what is known now as the double wage penalty statute, which took its present form approximately in 1872. That statute provides, in essence, Your Honors, that if a seaman on a foreign voyage, such as the petitioner was found to be by the trial court in this case, is not timely and properly paid his earned wages, those wages which are rightfully and uncontestedly due to him, 1/3 of those wages on the date of his discharge and the remainder within 4 days thereafter, that every master or owner who refuses or neglects to make payment without sufficient cause in a manner provided by the statute shall pay to the seaman a sum equal to 2 days' pay for each and every day during which such delay shall continue. Your Honors, that is the heart of the case here today. In this particular case, the trial court found uncontestedly that the seaman, the petitioner, had been denied by the respondent his wages, that he had made timely demand for his wages, and that even though demand had been timely demanded and with diligence he had pursued his demand, that the respondent failed in an unreasonable manner, acted recalcitrantly, callously, willfully, and wantonly, and failed to pay the petitioner his wages as called for by the statute, Your Honor.
I got lost a little bit in the arithmetic here, Counsel. What were the, in dollars, what were the actual dollars he lost for the actual days, apart from all the penalty provisions?
All right, Your Honor. If I may regress to the facts just a little bit then. The petitioner was actually due on his discharge $412.50, the amount of money which had been withheld from his paycheck and was to be paid to him when he was discharged. The actual facts are, Your Honor, that the petitioner was at work as a seaman on board the respondent's vessel, which was the Labarge 27. He received injuries which were due solely to an unseaworthy condition of that vessel. He had to leave the vessel to have minor surgery and to recuperate from his injuries. He left the vessel, Your Honor, on April the 1st of 1976. At that time, the respondent had withheld from his paycheck $412.50 that was to be paid to him on the date of his discharge. He was not paid that money, Your Honor, and when he was discharged in the port of Rotterdam, the trial court found that the respondent acted unreasonably, callously, willfully, and wantonly in disregard of his rights to receive those wages. Subsequently, the petitioner attempted with due diligence, as the trial court found, to collect those wages, but was denied the wages, Your Honor. Now, the real thrust of this case, Your Honor, is not the validity nor the applicability of the statute, but the size of the penalty which the statute carries with it. If I may read to the Court the one sentence in the statute, which I believe is the heart of the case. It reads, Your Honors, every master or owner who refuses or neglects to make payment in the manner herein before mentioned, without sufficient cause, shall pay to the seaman a sum equal to 2 days' pay for each and every day during which payment is delayed beyond the respective periods, which sum shall be recoverable as wages.
Mr. Chafin, I gather he got a judgment in the aggregate of $23,670.
He did, Your Honor.
And of that, only $6,881.60 is penalty wages?
That is true, Your Honor.
Is that the only item in issue before us?
That is, Your Honor. He was awarded damages for injuries and for maintenance and cure.
Maintenance and cure, prejudgment interest, attorney's fees, and recovery for pain and suffering.
That is correct, Your Honor.
But isn't the $5,000 recovery for pain and suffering and penalty wages?
No, sir, Your Honor. The respondent in this case has satisfied the judgment in full.
For the 68?
He has paid the $6,800 also, Your Honor.
Oh.
The issue before this court, Your Honor, is whether or not the trial court could exercise its equitable discretion to shorten the running of the penalty or to reduce the penalty to an amount which is below that called for by the plain and clear language of the statute.
I know, but now, what I'm trying to get at is the only item we have is the penalty wages of 68.81.
That is the sole issue before this Court, Your Honor.
Right. And you suggest that there's an argument that it ought to be less. How much less?
No, Your Honor.
None.
I suggest that the position of the Court should be...
No.
I beg your pardon.
Does your adversary say it will be less than 68.81 or nothing?
Your Honor, he does not contest the $6,800. That has been paid in satisfaction of judgment. My adversary takes the position that the judgment of the trial court was correct.
The $23,000?
Yes, sir. Yes, Your Honor.
You say it should be more.
That's correct, Your Honor.
What's the figure you suggest, sir?
Your Honor, the figure that I suggest will come to something around $300,000 when you apply the statute exactly as written.
Mr. Chafin, under your theory, would it continue to run until this very day because it isn't paid?
No,
what
ma'am.
About during the course of appeal?
No, Your Honor. That question was answered by this Court in the case of Pacific Mail against Schmidt, 1916, written by Justice Holmes, Your Honor. The Court there held...
Do you interpret that holding as saying that the Court has discretion then not to give it during the appellate period? Is that your interpretation of that?
The direct holding was that the penalty would not run during what was there a good-faith appeal, Your Honor. I do not know whether...
Was that on the theory that the Court had discretion?
Well, the theory is not announced there or not stated to be discretionary, Your Honor. It's simply stated that the... Court simply stated, I believe, that it was not the intent of Congress there, that that penalty should continue to accrue then.
But the literal language would not appear to admit for that distinction either. So I'm wondering whether the Court may have discretion that goes back further.
Well, Your Honor, in the Pacific Mail case, the trial court entered a judgment that inflicted the penalty up through the date of the decree of the trial court. And the appellant sought to have that decree reviewed. The Court of Appeals then acted to add to the penalty during the appellate procedure, and the Supreme Court's action, Your Honor, was simply to delete what the Court of Appeals had added, but not to review the judgment of the trial court where they had exercised the penalty for the entire period up until the date of the district court's decree.
But there's nothing in the language of the statute, is there?
There is not,
Your Honor. To justify that.
There is not, Your Honor.
Mr. Chafin, I suppose it's totally irrelevant, but... I take it he has long since recovered from his discomfiture.
He made an uneventful recovery, Your Honor, and the petitioner does not in this case contend that the respondent's failure to pay his wages inflicted greater injuries upon him, Your Honor. I would, in reply to...
Were they unable to obtain surgical advice for his hemorrhoidal condition in Brussels?
No, Your Honor. He had hospitalization treatment in Brussels and actually reported back to the vessel while it was still in the port of Rotterdam. And while it was still in the port of Rotterdam, and his superintendent, his supervisor, is the individual who actually denied the payment of his wages to him. And that is found by the trial court in its findings of fact and is uncontested.
I have the impression from either your brief or somewhere that he had a complete recovery from
him. He did have a complete recovery, Your Honor.
Very, very quickly.
Within 5 weeks, he had recovered and returned to work, Your Honor.
Well, did he press his claim with the employer for
this penalty wage?
The trial court found that he did press his claim with due diligence.
In what way?
He made telephone calls and he attempted to collect his wages. We also instituted suit within 16 months following that, Your Honor, and after the institution.
It took 16 months before you instituted suit?
Well, he tried without avail to collect his wages, Your Honor, up until September of the following year without the aid of counsel.
Not that it matters, but in Houston, this case was tried, right?
This case was tried in Sherman, Texas, Your Honor.
In Sherman?
The Eastern District of Texas.
Well, that's about 30 miles from Houston, from Dallas.
Yes, sir.
And this man had been injured in Sherman. How much would he have collected? If he'd gotten the same injury on land in Sherman, as a lawyer, how much would you assume he would collect?
Your Honor, the penalty wage statute applies only to seaman's injuries. He would not receive any penalty at all had he received any recovery at all.
I said if he was working for a truck company that had no connection with the sea at all, and he had gotten the same injury, and suffered the same injury in the same amount of time, and he had sued for damages, about how much would he have collected?
He would have collected nothing but his actual damages, Your Honor.
Sir?
He would have collected only his actual damages in that particular instance.
It would be about, $100?
No, Your Honor. It would be $412.50 plus his attorney's fees and collecting.
And solely because this happened on the sea, you get $300,000?
No, Your Honor. He will get that amount solely because the Congress saw fit to pass a penalty provision. And if I might, Your Honor.
Counsel, before you proceed, I'm not sure I understand how you get up to $300,000. If the $412 had been paid on May 5th, would that have ended the matter?
It would have, Your Honor.
Right.
It would have.
Then you multiply 202 by the number of days.
By each and every day during
April 1 until the district court decided the case.
That's correct, Your Honor.
What was actually withheld, sir?
Counsel.
What was actually withheld? Your Honor, he was on
what wages were actually withheld?
The actual mechanism of withholding was that he was paid every 2 weeks, Your Honor, and that the respondent withheld $137.50 from his paycheck.
Each week?
Each 2 week period.
In order to cover the possibility of his having to be sent home?
That's right, Your Honor.
So this was, they failed to pay over to him the withholding?
That's right, Your Honor. There's also an obligation under the maritime law that if the event that a seaman is injured while in the service of his vessel, his employer is required to repatriate.
Well, I understand that, but that has nothing to do with this statute.
It does not, Your Honor.
Nor with this case.
That's right.
So do you think that withholding is wages for the purposes of the statute?
The trial court so found, Your Honor. It was withheld from his wages. He earned the money, and they failed to pay him that money.
Is that what you demanded?
Yes, it is, Your Honor.
That's what was refused?
That's what was refused, Your Honor.
Now, suppose they had paid you $411.50. Would you be making the same claim?
I would not, Your Honor. I think the statute reads without sufficient cause, and I would not think that if they had made a simple clerical error, Your Honor.
Well, no. They just said there's no explanation. What if they said, we'll pay you $400?
Well, in that
I guess just literally the statute applies.
I wouldn't think that literally it would. It perhaps might apply literally, Your Honor, but the court, this very court has interpreted the without sufficient cause provision of the statute to mean that it must be a callous, recalcitrant, a unreasonable withholding.
Did you have to pay your, did your client have to pay his own way home?
He did, Your Honor.
Well, that, but callous and recalcitrant goes to the employer's state of mind, not to the amount withheld, doesn't it? I mean, supposing in Justice White's example that they had said, we'll pay you $400 and no more. You may think you've got a claim to $12, but we're just not going to fool around with it. We don't care what the rights of the matter are. Now, wouldn't you still have a claim under the statute?
I believe that you would, Your Honor.
Yes.
If I might point out to the Court, Your Honor, there is also provision that if the amount of the wage is in dispute and the employer or the respondent feels he has a good faith defense to that, then the proper procedure there, Your Honor, is to tender that money into the registry of the court. Let it be known that a dispute is had as to that amount.
Counsel, what court should the defendant have tendered the money into?
In this particular instance, Your Honor, the defendant could have tendered the money into the trial court's registry.
But that would have been a couple of years after. They would have had a couple of years of penalty wages accrued, wouldn't they?
That's correct, Your Honor. I would point out also that throughout this case, the respondent.
What would they have had to tender under either the? Would they have had to tender just the $412, or would they plus all the penalty wages that accrued up to that date?
It is my understanding of the case law, Your Honor, that it would simply be a tender of the wages due.
And so they could have done that any time?
Any time, Your Honor.
Before or after suit?
Before or after suit, Your Honor. That's correct.
Mr. Chapman, I think you told me earlier that without the help of counsel in this
room, the petitioner made demands upon the employer.
He did, Your Honor.
How frequently were those demands made?
Well, Your Honor, the evidence introduced at the trial court was that he made the demand when he left their employ, and there were records of telephone records there that he had telephoned his employer on several occasions previous to that or subsequent to that. In addition, he wrote them a letter asking for his wages, Your Honor.
And in each instance, what he was asking for was the $412?
Well, he was asking for the $412 as well as other elements. He was asking for the money back that he'd had to pay his own way home. They had lost some of his personal effects, and he was asking that he be repaid those things, but he was not asking for any damages for his injuries, Your Honor.
And in each instance, did he get a response from the employer to his demand?
In effect, he did not, Your Honor.
You mean they simply didn't answer him?
Well, if he would get a telephone call, he would simply receive a reply that we'll look into it or whatever. But at the time of the trial, Your Honor, the respondent brought forth two of their own witnesses from their home office, and those witnesses did not offer any reason nor any excuse as to why the petitioner's wages had never been paid.
No explanation of any kind?
No explanation whatsoever, Your Honor.
May I ask one other question? I may have misunderstood your answer. Did you say they could have made the tender before or after suit?
Either way, Your Honor. They could
have would they have made the tender before a suit was filed?
Well, they would have just paid him the $412.
And which would have left due and left in dispute any of the penalty wages.
That's correct, Your Honor.
No, but my question is, you still haven't answered my question.
I beg your pardon, Your Honor.
My question is, if they wanted to still dispute the $412 but pay it into court somewhere, where could they have paid it before a suit was filed?
They could have filed their own lawsuit, Your Honor.
Oh, I see.
They could have paid them, too.
The statute provides, Your Honor, that it is a sum recoverable as wages, not that it is his wages that he is recovering, Your Honor. The penalty portion is not a wage itself. It is a sum recoverable as wages, a sum equal to 2 days' pay. But it is not to be considered as wages, Your Honor. A portion of the respondents, and I think the significant thrust of their argument, goes to the point that, in the respondent's opinion, this is to be considered as compensatory remedialing measure, Your Honor.
Let me ask again. They withheld $412. Now, the penalty is 2 days'
pay.
Wages, full 2 days. It isn't just twice what they withheld.
No, Your Honor, it is a sum equal to 2 days' pay for each and every day during which the withholding continues. It is not 2 days' wages, Your Honor. It is a sum equal to that, and there is a distinction there.
But it's not a sum equal to what they've withheld.
It is not, Your Honor. The sum that they have withheld bears no relationship to the penalty inflicted by the statute. This Court, Your Honor, in 1930, speaking through Justice Stone, a case called Colley against Ferguson, when this very statute was before the Court, said, Your Honor, that the petitioners argue that the statutory allowance is compensatory. However, the words refuses or neglects to make payment without sufficient cause connote conduct which is in some sense arbitrary or willful, or at least a forfeiture not attributable to impossibility of payment. We think the use of this language indicates a purpose to protect seamen from delayed payment of wages by the imposition of a liability which is not exclusively compensatory, but designed to prevent, by its coercive effect, arbitrary refusals to pay.
Does that suggest, Mr. Chaffee, that the employer has absolutely no equitable defenses at all?
The statute does not provide for equitable defenses. Employers.
Do our cases touch on whether or not the employer has any equitable defenses?
Your Honor, there is a case out of this Court called McCrae against the United States. That case is once again by Justice Stone in 1934. In that particular case, Your Honor, the petitioner, who was a seaman, urged on the Court that his wages had been withheld from him without sufficient cause. The trial court found that they had not been withheld, that the seaman had not presented himself to receive his wages. However, after that, the seaman took the position that the failure to pay without sufficient cause activated the penalty even after the period of time which they were originally due to him. Mr. Justice Stone, in that case, Your Honor, said that you do not consider events which happened beyond the time period set forth in the statute, that the statute provides a reasonable and a definite manner in which the seaman can recover the penalty. Now, Your Honor, I believe that that is a perfect analogy to this case, because what the respondent is attempting to do here, truly, Your Honor, is to draw into issue facts that occurred after the statute had been triggered.
Yeah. Yes, but they did, in the Pacific Mail case, draw into consideration the fact that a judgment had been entered and there was reasonable cause to appeal it.
In the Pacific Mail case?
Post-event fact.
Well, Your Honor, I believe that that is clearly distinguishable. For one thing, in the Pacific Mail case.
Well, all I'm making the suggestion is that sometimes you can look at post-occurrence facts.
Your Honor, yes, you can, Your Honor, but those occurrences they were talking about there were post-judgment occurrences. Now, the Supreme Court in that case also said, Your Honor, that they need not reach the issue of whether or not the cause of action had merged into the judgment, which is the common
ordinary. Because they said there was sufficient cause for appeal. They read the word sufficient cause to apply to the later period of time.
That's right, Your Honor. That's correct.
What if an employer, upon receiving the demand, simply said, you're wrong, you have not any wages coming. And then there was a dispute. Then would it turn on what the court would ultimately find on whether, first, there was a bona fide dispute, and second, whether their conduct was using these strong terms that have been mentioned.
If the employer owed the wages, Your Honor, the dispute would turn, or the applicability of the statute would turn, on whether or not the withholding was without sufficient cause. Now, if the employer wants to take that risk, they may do so, Your Honor. The more reasonable approach is to tender the wages, to pay constructively the seaman's wages into the registry of the court, and then proceed from that point forward.
Tender the wages claimed in full settlement and final binding disposition of all pending claims.
That's right, Your Honor. That's right.
You say that would be the way to wash it?
That is the more reasonable approach.
All he would have to do is tender $412 to stop the accumulation of any penalty.
That's right, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. That's right.
He has to do that within the time, 2-day time.
No, Your Honor. He can tender the wages at any time after the statute.
Well, but there'd be penalty if he would got if he
would
delays
stop
until after the 2-day time period, even if for only 10 days. The penalty wages at least for the 10 days, isn't that right?
That's right, Your Honor. I'll point out to the court, Your Honor, that this statute had its origin in 1790, but in 1872, the statute originally read that the penalty would be a sum not greater than 2 days' pay for a time period not exceeding 10 days. It gave the judiciary discretion. That provision was consciously deleted from the statute in 1898 by the Congress, Your Honors, at which time the penalty was changed to be 1 day's pay for each and every day during which the penalty continued. So the legislative history of the statute, Your Honor, even though it be skimpy, I would say to the Court, is contained actually in the evolution of the statute itself, in that the statute originally contained a provision that allowed the trial court discretion. That provision was removed by the Congress, Your Honor. It was a provision that was removed after the bill had been passed to the 54th Congress in 1896 and went to the Senate in 1898. So the shipping industry, as well as the seamen, had a perfect opportunity to have both of their sides urged, Your Honor. And even with that, that was consciously deleted. Now, I point out, Your Honor, that in the case
of — But in 1890, the seamen were not organized. The seamen were not organized.
They were not organized as well, Your Honor. No quarrel with that.
Would it?
They got a very fine result, Your Honor.
And furthermore, they got the — it used to be one — when it was 1898, it was 1 day's pay.
And that's right. In 1915, it was up to 2 days' pay.
And it was mandatory.
Mandatory, Your Honor.
Could that have been because Congress thought they needed protection?
That is exactly why it is, Your Honor. The seamen —
They still need that protection.
They do, Your Honor.
Why? They've got a union. They're organized.
Well, Your Honor, when you're at sea and discharged in a foreign port, the union and your organization may not be nearly so assistive to you as you might think, Your Honor. The dangers of the seaman once —
talk to any captains recently.
All right.
Mr. Chaffin, I know you — I think you answered this question when my brother Powell asked you earlier. What's the starting date for the penalty wages,
Your Honor,
under your submission? What day?
Under my submission, Your Honor?
Yes.
The starting date is April 1, the date that he
— April 1, what year?
1976, Your Honor.
And what's the terminal date?
May the 6th, 1980, the date of the district court's decree.
And it's the double wages for that period from April 76 to 1980?
That's right, Your Honor.
Brings out the $300,000?
That's right, Your Honor.
Why should it terminate with the rendering of the district court's judgment?
That's the holding Pacific Mail, Your Honor.
That it automatically terminates, or that it terminates only if the employer had good reason to appeal, or
there is no authority on that, Your Honor. I suppose that if it was a bad faith appeal, that the appellate court could continue to have the penalty accrue. But the standard rule of law there is that every cause of action merges into the judgment that's entered on that cause of action, and I see no reason to distinguish this statute from that, Your Honor. Other than that, Your Honor, I would save some time for rebuttal, but I would point out to the court that in the interpretation of these statutes, where neither the validity nor the applicability of the statute is challenged, which it is not here, Your Honor, and the words of the statute are plain and unambiguous, that simply because the statute brings with it a harsh financial result, a severe penalty, that the courts cannot sit in review and reverse what is a conscious decision of the Congress.
With the stringent provisions of the statute that you've just referred to, harsh you call them, be told if the employer had tendered $412 into a court to be impounded until the case was resolved, would that stop it?
That's a constructive payment of the seaman's wages, Your Honor, and it would stop it according to the case law.
On that one point, is there statutory support for your suggestion that that tender of that amount would be sufficient to?
No, Your Honor.
Yeah, that's based on one court of appeals.
No, Your Honor, that's based on several courts of appeals.
Is that right?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Culler.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. There is but a single issue in this case, and that is whether or not the trial judge had discretion to determine the period for which the penalty under Section 596 of Title 46 would run. I was somewhat surprised to hear counsel say this morning that the time of the penalty would stop with a rendition of the district court's decree, because everything that he has submitted has indicated that the penalty would simply run on into perpetuity until paid. A literal wording of the statute would require that result.
But do you agree with him that if you had tendered the $412 at any time, the accrual would have stopped?
I think that would be true, Your Honor.
Yes, thanks.
Yes.
Including tendering it to a court to be impounded, or must it have been given just tendered to the party, the employee?
Your Honor, I'm not aware, Mr. Chief Justice, I'm not aware of a case specifically passing on this point. There are suggestions in the cases that the funds might have been tendered in some fashion, but I'm not aware of a case where specifically has been held.
The statute permits it, I mean.
The statute says nothing about it.
Mm-hmm.
The statute is silent on
Mr. Galler, may I ask, I gather the district judge picked a 30-day period. That was approximately the time the petitioner was out of work, was it not?
May I expand on the facts just a little bit for the Court's edification? This petitioner was a welder by trade who was employed by contract with my client in New Orleans to go to Antwerp to join a pipe-laying barge that was then being made ready to go into the North Sea and conduct pipe-laying operations. In the contract, it provided that the employer would be entitled to deduct from his pay $137.50 for each of the first pay periods to be applied against his return transportation in the event that he breached his contract. Maybe his girlfriend would write him and said, I want you home, so he got the first airplane home and came back to the United States. That is the purpose of the provision in the contract. When he arrived in Antwerp, he worked on the pipe-laying barge in the harbor for the period from March 7, 1976 until April 1, 1976, which was the day that he had difficulty with his pre-existing hemorrhoids and went into the hospital in Antwerp for treatment for the hemorrhoid condition. When he came out of the hospital, he was offered the option of taking care of himself in Antwerp or coming home to make his recovery. He chose to come home. In fact, he purchased his airplane ticket while he was still in the hospital before he ever reported back to the barge. He returned to Houston. He was seen a couple of times by a colon specialist in Houston, a rectal specialist. He was pronounced fit for duty on May 3, 1976. He actually did go back to work for another employer in the North Sea, in the same type of employment, on May the 5th, 1976. So the period...
Exactly out of work.
34 days.
34. And the district judge gave the penalty wages, as I understand it, for approximately 30 days. Did he?
For exactly 34 days.
34. So he picked the time that he was actually out of work as the limit of his entitlement to the...
That is correct. And he doubled his straight-time wages of $101.20 a day to arrive at a figure of $202.40 a day times $34, and it figures out exactly $6,881.
Of course, suppose he'd been out of work only 2 or 3 days. Do you suppose that would have been a fair limit?
Well, of course, we take the position, Your Honor, that the construction of the statute and the determination of the penalty period for which the statute should run should rest entirely in the discretion of the trial judge.
As an
or of this court, if
as an equitable matter?
Sir?
As an equitable matter?
That's right, Your Honor. And the First, the Second, the Fourth, and the Fifth Circuits have adopted that position. The only circuits that have held to the contrary are the Third and the Ninth. The Ninth, based on the Third Circuit decision, which we believe to be incorrectly decided.
Isn't there a problem whether the statute permits that interpretation as authorizing the district judge to do that?
If one should look literally at nothing but the words of the statute, yes, Your Honor, there is a problem.
Well, is there anything in this record to indicate why the wages weren't paid over?
Mr. Justice, some
basis for an equitable discretion?
Mr. Justice, there is not. And again, if I may expand on the facts a little bit, when this gentleman left Antwerp to come back, as the record will reveal, the exhibits will reveal, there were telephone calls made from the New Orleans office of Oceanic Contractors, the respondent, attempting to get back in touch with him to get him to return to work. There are telex messages that were between Oceanic.
Did he make a demand for his wages in Antwerp?
He says he did.
Did the district court find he did? The
district court found he did as a matter in dispute.
Was it denied? Did the employer deny that he made such a demand?
I don't recall that the employers, the testimony that we put on at the trial really went to that point. Mm-hmm. So we've assumed that the district judge is correct in the handling of the case and have really not contested
that. The demand
that point
was made and was just not, and the money was just not paid.
Mr. Justice White, the reason that the money was not paid, if the demand was in fact made, was because we expected him to come back to Antwerp and go back to work and honor his contract.
Well, where do you find that in the
district
court's
That isn't even in the records.
That he was coming back?
Yes.
The testimony in the transcript of the testimony shows that very clearly, Justice Brown.
Could you cite to some place in the findings of the district court where he makes a finding on that?
I do not believe there is a finding. I'm simply reciting the evidence as it appeared in the district court. The district judge did find that the withholding of the $412.50 was without sufficient cause. We do not contest that.
He found it was callous also, didn't he?
He did.
Aren't we bound by those findings, counsel?
Yes, we have not contested the findings, and I think under Rule 56 you are bound, Your Honor.
How do you read discretion into the language of the statute?
I think you really have to look at the history of the statute itself and to realize and consider the role of the Admiralty Courts. The Admiralty Courts have been accepted as the protectors of seamen's rights from the time this statute was enacted originally in 1790. And that's shown by a clear reading of the statute, because the statute itself provides that the master must respond in admiralty. The Congress, as early as 1790, was aware and knew that this statute would be construed in an admiralty court. And when you, as it is reenacted.
Just because it's an admiralty court, we have to read in discretion?
I say yes, Your Honor, because it is an admiralty court and because the admiralty courts have traditionally been the protectors of the seaman's right, I say that Congress enacted this statement with that knowledge beforehand, with the understanding that the admiralty courts would protect the rights of these seamen. Judge?
I'm still worried about knowing all of this that you talked about, and your client knew all of this. Why couldn't they have gotten out of this with $400? Why?
Your Honor, I suppose.
Why did they choose not to?
With hindsight, I think this is exactly what happened. The petitioner came back to the United States. The operational office was in Antwerp. And I think it really was a matter of inadvertence, despite what Judge Justice found, that they didn't make the payment.
Which is what Congress didn't want to happen.
I believe that's right, Your Honor.
And $300,000 will break you out of the habit.
That's right. Your Honor, if the same thing would be true if $1 were inadvertently withheld as a consequence of an honest mistake, if there was no finding of sufficient cause, The penalty over the period of 4.5 years or whatever it is, some 1,600 days, would result in a payment of $324,000.
Well, it certainly is strange after the lawsuit was started, and at least somebody in the company must have known the lawsuit was going on.
They did, Your Honor. That is, of course, the reason that the respondent paid off the judgment in September 1980. The judgment was paid September 17, 1980. But we think at the heart of this case is the fact that the statute itself is a remedial statute. It's not a penalty statute. It's not penal in nature. The statute provides that these sums shall be recoverable as wages, not as penalties. And if we turn to this Court's holding in Pacific Mail against Schmidt, we say that that case is direct authority for the proposition that the Court has discretion for setting the time of the penalty. In that case, a seaman who returned from a foreign voyage was paid his wages through a date, September 23, 1913. He stayed on the vessel for 7 or 8 days later and then was discharged when they found some silverware missing and accused him of taking it. So they offset the value of the silverware against the wages due him for those 8 days. And the trial judge found that the offset was unlawful, was without sufficient cause, and invoked the penalty up until the date of trial, which was a date like November 1981, 45 days or so. The Court of Appeals extended that penalty through the date of the appeal. When it got to the Supreme Court, the Court held that there was sufficient cause for taking the appeal, and therefore the period of the penalty would stop as of the date of the district court's decree. Now, logically, once there is a finding that the wages were withheld without sufficient cause, then it seems to me that no court after that can come along and say that the penalty will run for 30 days or 60 days or 90 days, and then the penalty shall stop. Because if you read the statute literally, the penalty is payable, if it is a penalty, is payable for each and every day that payment is withheld. So literally, it's payable until paid, which in our case, frankly, would be September 17, 1980.
What about your opponent's argument that the claim merges in the judgment, and once you have a judgment, the rules governing payment of judgments would govern rather than the statute?
That is not what this Court held in Pacific Mail. What this Court did hold in Pacific Mail was that there was sufficient cause for the shipowner taking the appeal from the district court's judgment, and that's all that it held. We do not think that there is a merger under the circumstances if you read the statute literally.
When you were in the district courts, were you then principally litigating the question of whether the $412 was due, or was the litigation focusing on the penalty provisions?
Mr. Chief Justice, the litigation focused on every aspect of the case, and that is why Judge Justice rendered the opinion he did. He found the vessel to be unseaworthy. We issued, of course, the facts of the case, the circumstances of this accident. He awarded $5,000 as general damages for the injuries caused by the unseaworthiness. He found that respondent also failed to pay maintenance for this period from the date of the accident up until May 3, when the petitioner was found fit for duty. So he awarded not only the maintenance, but he awarded a sum for attorney's fees under this Court's decision in Vaughan against Atkinson, that the failure to pay maintenance was improper.
Are there any cases which give any intimation that the earnings from other employments are to be credited against the ultimate amount of the claim, as that would be the case with a violation of the civil rights laws denying employment, something of that kind?
There are no such direct holdings to our knowledge, Your Honor.
Did you make any proffer
of evidence of wages from other jobs by way of mitigation?
Yes, we did. We showed the petitioner's wages for Viking Offshore Company, which is the company that he commenced working for on May 5, 1976, which was 34 days after his accident.
Was that proffer accepted by the district court or refused?
It was accepted in the sense that we feel that all those factors came into the district court's decision in setting the penalty period at 34 days, the time that he returned to work. That's what he
you
specifically
said earlier in your argument that your view is that these amounts are paid as wages?
Yes, sir. Under the statute, says specifically these shall be recoverable as wages.
Even though he was working somewhere else and making comparable wages?
Well, I think the statute is speaking to the fact that these sums to be recovered will be wages and not penalties,
well,
Mr. Chief Justice.
As the Chief Justice says, a normal rule would be to set off amounts earned elsewhere.
I know of no decisions permitting a set-off in these cases.
Well, has there ever been any decisions that, denying it?
Not that I can recall, and I can't.
Certainly none here, are there?
And there are none that we've cited.
You spoke none. Of the failure to pay the $412 in Antwerp on demand, the demand of which the company seemed to be perhaps not fully aware, was a result of inadvertence. Now, you mean the kind of inadvertence that takes 8 days to get a letter from Baltimore to Washington? Or what kind of inadvertence do you mean? Did somebody just drop the ball? Is that it?
I think that is it, Mr. Chief Justice. When the petitioner returned to the pipelaying barge following his discharge from the hospital in Antwerp.
That's certainly not what the district court said. The district court said the refusal to pay unearned wages to plaintiff constituted arbitrary, unreasonable, callous, and willful disregard of the plaintiff's rights. That certainly doesn't square with your answer that it's an inadvertent thing.
Well, Mr. Justice Rehnquist, I'm going back and drawing on the facts, the transcript, the testimony that was in evidence.
Did you ever challenge any of the district court's findings? Did you appeal from the district court to the Court of Appeals?
We did not.
And you haven't cross-appealed from the judgment of the Fifth Circuit, have you?
We did not.
Aren't you bound by those findings?
We are bound by those findings, and I understand that.
Your only challenge is that the Court of Appeals was entitled to, and the District Court, entitled to read the statute as they did read it. You're not challenging the $23,000 recovery.
We are not.
For the $412 of wages.
We are not. So far as we know, that $412.50 was not, in fact, paid. And the trial judge found that it was not paid. The only thing we are saying is that the trial judge was correct in exercising his discretion to limit the period of the penalty. And that he has that discretion, and that is vested in the Admiralty Courts.
Is there anything in the record to show what his
earnings were at the you said you made a proffer, what his earnings were with the other employer? Was it at the same rate, comparable rate?
Well, I do not know the rate. There is evidence in the form of an exhibit in the file showing, I believe, what his earnings were. And as I recall, it was around $6,500 for a short period of time. There is evidence.
Did he work continuously from the time he went back to work?
He worked for a short period.
But not continuously?
Not continuously, nor would he have worked continuously for the respondent because the pipelaying season lasts in the North Sea only from the time the vessels can get out in the spring until they have to come in the fall. And there was a finding, as I recall, by the trial judge that the pipelaying season would have terminated on September 15 of 1976.
Mr. Bell, I gather your whole case turns on our accepting your submission that because it's an admiralty, the statute nevertheless necessarily is in its application of admiralty is conditioned on
and equitable discretion in the trial judge to do what he thinks is the just thing to do in terms of fixing the penalty period.
I feel that's a fair summation of our position based upon the decisions of the First, Second, Fourth, and Fifth Circuits. We feel the only case to the contrary really is the Swain case of the Third Circuit, and that the Swain court simply misinterpreted this court's holding in the Pacific Mail versus Schmidt case, because in that case, that's exactly what this court did. After the penalty had been invoked, had been triggered, and had run for some period of time, as I recall, around 45 to 60 days, in any event, from September 13th to about November the 11th, then this court held that the penalty should cease at that time. So if we read the statute literally, this court would not be empowered to make that holding. Now, they did it. The court did this by saying that there was sufficient cause for the appeal. But if we accept petitioner's argument and literally, slavishly, blindly apply this statute, then it would go on and on and on forever until paid.
The harsh terms of the district court's finding, apparently cast in terms of the traditional analysis of this statute, hardly laid a very good foundation for his invoking equitable discretion. Would you agree?
Yes, unless and with and if you view simply that finding without taking into consideration all of the evidence in the case, the fact that the injuries were very minor in nature, that when the petitioner returned to the United States, he saw the physician only twice, and within a period of 31 days, he was declared fit for duty, and the fact that he'd had a prior hemorrhoid condition, and this was simply a recurrence of it, that he went right back to work and was able to perform his work as well as he had prior to the injury.
I could understand an argument about discretion better if there was some defensible reason given for the failure to pay, if there was a dispute over whether there was cause for withholding or not. You might say the Congress certainly didn't intend to impose this this penalty if there was a reasonably arguable reason for withholding, but there's nothing in this record to indicate any justifiable cause for withholding, is there?
Well, I think there is, Mr. Justice.
This is just argument that even though we deliberately withheld it, there's nevertheless discretion to disregard the statute.
Well, I think there is only when you consider the totality of the circumstances and all of the evidence the judge had before him when he decided this case.
Well, that may be, as Justice Rehnquist says, if there were different findings, that might help you, but.
Of course, if there are different findings, there wouldn't have been any penalty wages. They had to make the finding of deliberate withholding to justify even one day of penalty wages.
To justify any penalty, it had to be without sufficient cause.
Right. What is equitable reason? Is too much money?
So they can't have a case where there'd be discretion if you are bound by the findings.
Yes, there had to be a finding without sufficient cause in order to trigger the statute initially. And whether you word it as callous, arbitrary, willful, wanton, or whatever, there has to be that finding.
Well, but that's to say it's without sufficient cause is one thing. To say it's unreasonable, callous, and willful disregard is another. I mean, the district court wouldn't have had to make those findings in order to find that it was without sufficient cause.
Well, again, all I can say, Mr. Justice Rehnquist, is that is what this particular trial judge did find. What another trial judge might find on the same facts might be entirely different.
Well, doesn't the law in the Fifth Circuit require the malicious-type finding in order to justify the conclusion that it was without sufficient cause?
I believe that it does.
So that in order to find any penalty wages, he had to find this kind of malice.
That's
in
right.
The Fifth Circuit?
Certainly the statute doesn't require that, does it?
The statute does not require that. We acknowledge
we're
that.
Bound by the statute, I take it, not by the Fifth Circuit's rule.
Well,
that's the statute as construed in the Fifth Circuit requires.
That's correct. The decisional law requires it.
What case requires it, by the way?
American Federation versus Dahl, D-A-H-L, Your Honor.
So that in the Fifth Circuit, you think that if the trial judge thought, well, it was reasonably arguable when they denied it, it wasn't malicious, then there would be discretion.
The opinion indicates
that. They say there's discretion even if it were malicious.
If the Fifth Circuit should have a case where the trial judge would simply hold that the withholding was without sufficient cause, I believe the Fifth Circuit would allow the penalty to stand. The Fifth Circuit does.
Well, it didn't in this case.
Well, it affirmed the judgment of the,
well,
of the district judge.
There were findings that it was malicious, or something to that effect, anyway. And yet they didn't allow the penalty to stand.
Yes, Your Honor, the $6,881.60 is part of the total judgment.
I understand that, but they certainly didn't allow the running beyond the 34 days.
But that's true. They did not reverse the decision of Judge Justice and reinstitute the penalty. If the Court please, might I just call attention to another statute which this Court has interpreted that I think justifies our position in this case, that the Court has discretion in interpreting a statute. Section 5 of the Longshore Act provides that the liability of an employer for compensation under that act shall be exclusive and in place of all other liability to the injured longshoreman or anyone entitled to recover compensation under that longshoreman. When you read that statute, the literal wording of the statute, you read it clearly. That's what it says, and that's all it says. Yet this Court, in Reed against Yakka and in Jackson versus Likes Brothers, held that where a longshoreman is employed directly by a compensation-paying employer who is also a shipowner, then the shipowner is not immune from tort liability. And the longshoreman may sue the ship owner directly for damages under the general maritime law. Specifically, those cases held that he had a cause of action for damages for unseaworthiness. Now, that statute was amended in 1972, and the longshoreman's remedy for unseaworthiness was eliminated. And since that time, the appellate courts have held that the longshoreman nevertheless still retains his direct action against his employer under the principles of maritime negligence, so long as the quality of the negligence that causes the accident is negligence in the navigation of the vessel. The courts have distinguished the negligence in loading the cargo on the vessel, which is normally longshore work, and navigation of the vessel, which is operation of the ship. And I cite those cases to you simply to reaffirm that although the literal wording of the statute in question may say that the 2 days' wages or the double wages are payable until paid, certainly this longshore statute shows clearly that this Court and other federal courts, obviously, have the right to interpret these statutes to divine the intent of Congress. I think the history of this statute indicates that Congress intended to turn its administration over to the federal admiralty courts, and if Congress had been dissatisfied with it, it would have amended this statute, because for many years these cases have been on the books allowing the courts to exercise their discretion in determining the period of the penalty.
You referred to a case, I think, American Federation against Dahl, but I don't see it under that caption, at least, cited.
May I?
Yes, by all means. Perhaps I got the title wrong.
Sorry, Your Honor, I may have gotten my tongue twisted. It's Caribbean Federation Lines versus Dahl. That's the Fifth Circuit case on the point.
Thank you.
May I ask one question that's maybe pretty remote from the issue, but I notice the statute didn't apply to whaling vessels. Why not, I wonder?
I would.
Is there anything in the legislative history that explains that?
No, the statute also does not apply to fishing vessels in general because often those vessels, the seamen on those vessels are paid by shares or by the catch.
It seemed to me the whaling vessel example would have fallen right within the purpose of the statute.
Would think so. Incidentally, if I may refer back to Pacific Mail against Schmidt, in that case, the court held that there was grave doubt as to whether or not the statute should be invoked at all under the circumstances of that case because the petitioner in the case, or the respondent in the case, the seaman, was injured while the vessel was in port. And here we have the seaman who was injured while the vessel was in port. So the answer to this question is not all that, that clear-cut, but at least we feel that certainly that
is it correct that the conflict arose in, what was it, about 1966 or 67? Was there a conflict before then? When was the Third Circuit case decided? I had the impression that for about 50 years the statute was consistently construed to allow the district judge discretion.
In the Caribbean case, the Court of Appeals cites as authority the Mystic case in 20 Federal Second.
Yes.
That's fairly.
So that's a case that holds there's discretion. That's right.
That is how long the courts have so held. Thank you.
Mr. Chaffin, of course, we know the general proposition. Justice Frankfurter expressed so well that if a statute is clear, you don't need to look to the legislative history. But do you think Congress ever contemplated the possibility of a $320,000 payment for a $412 default?
Your Honor, I don't know that they thought up that exact figure, but I would suggest you
that
in relative terms, I think they did, Your
proportion.
Honor. I think they did in relative terms, Your Honor. I think so clearly that if you have a...
Or is it perhaps more accurate to say that Congress, as they often do, never gave it any thought one way or the other?
Your Honor, I don't really think that could be accurate in this case because the Congress consciously deleted the not more than form of penalty in 1898, which gave that limiting provision to the courts. And the bill was the subject of extended debate, Your Honor. I would suggest to the Court, Your Honor, that what's really happening here is that the respondent is attempting to make a backdoor challenge to the validity of the statute, Your Honors. That, in essence, the statute is clear and plain on its face, and that the rules interpreting the seaman statute are even more clear. That if there exists an ambiguity in a seaman statute, that ambiguity must be interpreted in favor of the seaman.
Let me ask you one question on your theory. When the statute, before 1915, had the not more than language in it. Was it not true that the district judge then had discretion to within the 10-day range?
That's true, Your Honor.
And now by limiting the 10-day ceiling, they took the 10-day ceiling, is it also clear they took away his discretion?
That's true, Your Honor. That's exactly our position, Your Honor.
Well, there are two different things that one amendment accomplished then.
Well, Your Honor,
is there anything in the legislative history to make it clear they intended to do both? One, it removed the limit on his discretion. Did it also entirely take away the discretion?
Well, Your Honor, the statute was clear on its face then that he could not exceed 10 days.
Right.
And when they removed that after two years...
Then he could exceed 10 days.
He could after that time, Your Honor.
Right.
It fixed the running of the statute according to the terms of the statute. I would suggest, Your Honor, that what's really at issue here has nothing to do with the wording of the statute. It is the impact of the statute, the financial burden which comes with it. And I would suggest further, Your Honors, that is not a proper matter for review by this Court, which is backed up by the case of Tennessee Valley Authority against Hill. In that case, Your Honor, decided by the Chief Justice and written by the Chief Justice, a 3-inch fish stopped a $100 million dam straight in its tracks, Your Honor.
$130 million.
So it's clear that if a statute is valid, if it's constitutional in the case of a seaman, he's been a protected breed of worker for several hundred years.
How do you explain the fact that for 50 years the courts of appeals consistently misconstrued the statute and Congress did nothing about it?
I have no explanation for that, Your Honor, except to say that the statute was lightly applied in those days, and in these days,
it was what?
Lightly applied. You do not find a great judicial history on the statute, Your Honor. But the case of Is Branson against Johnson came before this case in this court in 1952 involving this statute. Justice Burton then said, Your Honor, that in statutes which derogate the common law as known to the maritime law, those statutes must be strictly construed, and construed in the favor of the seaman if there be a doubt. That legislation remedial to the seaman is to be given the benefit of the doubt if there exists one in favor of the seaman, Your Honor.
Well, if you're going to get into maxims, you're up against the proposition that courts abhor a forfeiture, too, aren't you?
Courts what, Your Honor?
Abhor a forfeiture, which this really is.
This is not a forfeiture, Your Honor. This is a statute designed to prevent great potential harms. A seaman who is discharged in a foreign port without his wages can die there, Your Honor. It is a significant potential harm this statute is designed to prevent. But it has punch and impact.
Doesn't it take on the appearance, at least, of a forfeiture in traditional terms that when the sanction or the penalty is so out of proportion to the injury that then courts have construed such things as forfeitures?
I suppose you could take that approach, Your Honor, but that approach is rejected by numerous cases. The Ryder against Sonatone case, an antitrust case, was the same thing. The statute carries with it significant financial impact, and that is, in essence, the entire objection to the law, Your Honor. And I just cannot buy that the Congress could not foresee that after 2 years, that it's an old statute, and it has a punch and an impact, which is simply removed if you interpret it as the respondent would have, Your Honor. We would ask the court to stabilize the law and have a uniform period for the running of the statute.
Just one more question. Suppose if, and I underline the if.
Yes, sir.
This court concluded that the Fifth Circuit standard, its rule, was not correct. Would it be an appropriate remedy to declare that that was an improper standard and send it back to return to the district court so that the district court could re-examine it in light of what we would have then said is the correct interpretation of the statute?
Sorry.
Would that be the solution?
That would not be my solution, Your Honor.
Rather than an affirmance.
My solution, Your Honor, would be that the case be reversed and rendered with instruction.
Yes, I know, but I put an if. I put a hypothetical to you. If we concluded that their standard was wrong, would that be the appropriate disposition of the case?
If that was the conclusion, Your Honor, I would certainly think that you would also have to add, too, that you could not consider conduct outside the period of time prescribed by the statute. The only equitable conduct in this case was that the petitioner himself went out and found reemployment. Now, equitable conduct, by its nature, refers to some type of conduct that the respondent in this case should have come forward with. Your Honor, the record is absolutely clean of any conduct on the part of the respondent that they did anything to help the petitioner collect money that was rightfully due to him. In other words, the only equities in the case actually fall on the side of the petitioner, with the exception of the one equity which the respondent jumps on, Your Honor, and that's that it's a big penalty.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next.